Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Something I'm more excited about is how this view of knowledge relates to debunking arguments and undermining arguments. So those are arguments that don't attack the truth of your view directly. Maybe you hold some view, some political view, or a moral view, or a religious view. A rebutting objection or a rebutting defeater tries to convince you that your view is false. A debunking argument tries to undermine your view, try to show you that the reasons for your view are no good. So maybe your view is true, maybe it's false. The fact is you don't have good reasons for it. That's how debunking arguments work. So I'll try to explain to you why considerations about what debunking arguments are support this view of what knowledge is. Okay, so here are some things that Aquinas said relating to knowledge, and specifically philosophy of perception. Those are not lasers. That's like light bouncing off the bird into this guy's eyes. Okay, so here is my understanding of Aquinas' view of what happens in ordinary visual perception. So I'm borrowing here from Frederick Copleston, who says that when we view, in an ordinary case of perception, when we're looking at corporeal objects like a bird, those act upon the organs of sense. And sensation is an act of the body and the soul, not just the soul alone. And he says that the senses are naturally determined to the apprehension of particulars. The senses cannot apprehend universals or forms. So whereas animals or brutes have sensation, they can't grasp general ideas. So what we're about to see in a second is the difference between the human mind and a mere animal mind. So what happens is light bounces off this bird and goes into my eyes. So far, that can happen to animals as well. And what that produces is what Aquinas called a phantasm, or an image. And I think it's safe to assume this is pretty much what people meant when they talked about sense data. I don't know if you're familiar with sense data theory, sense datum theory. Or when you hear the moderns talking about impressions. It's the sort of thing that would be present even in hallucination. Or it's the sort of thing that's present in dreams, that sort of mental image. I guess if you close your eyes and like push on your eyes, you get those little phosphine things. I think that would count as this sort of mental entity, this phantasm or image. Okay, so far that's just a particular. It represents the object that we're seeing. So visual perception creates in us this little phantasm. We have that power to produce these phantasms. So it's perceived by the senses. It is itself a particular. It's the image of a particular object or objects. Human intellectual cognition, however, is of the universal. The human being in his intellectual operations apprehends the form of the material object in abstraction. He apprehends a universal. So that's, I guess, what separates us from the beasts, from the animals. The animals get this phantasm. They have that image of the object that they're seeing. But humans have an additional power. And here, this is from Christopher Brown in the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So here's how he puts it. He says, the agent gets a phantasm of the bird. She's at least conscious of a blue, smallish object with wings. And he says, from the phantasm, including experiences of similar phantasms that you remember, we've got this power of active intellect that abstracts what Thomas calls the intelligible species from the phantasm. That is, leaves aside those features that the agent recognizes as accidental to the object being cognized in order to focus on the essence of what's being cognized, the universal or the form. So we started with just that phantasm in perception, and then this power that we have of active intellect somehow produces in our minds the form or the universal. This is not an account of how that happens. So far, we've just named the process. We just are calling this process, whatever it is, the active intellect. And then we end up with this form in our minds. Here's how Rob Koons put it in a previous Thomistic Institute talk that you should listen to. Rob Koons at the University of Texas, former professor of mine. He says that when an accidental form is present in a natural substance, it makes that substance instantiate the corresponding accident. So when this form is present in a bit of matter, you get an actual bird. When it informs some actual matter, you get a bird. When the form is in your mind, however, when the form is in your mind, it makes the intellect understand that accident. So this form is present in our mind in something like the way it's present in matter, but important difference, when it's in matter, you get an actual bird. When the form is in our mind, you get understanding. That's the idea. Okay, and then there's just one final step on this view of perception. Finally, the intelligible species is transformed into an inner word or concept. There's conscious awareness of the quiddity or essence of what has been cognized, such that it's recognized as corresponding to a word, such as bird. So now our conceptual apparatus kicks in, and we get this like mental representation, this linguistic representation of this little form that is present in our intellect. We have a little thought or a belief, like here's a bird. Okay, so that's what Aquinas says about perception. That's how it works. And again, I'll just flag, like, this is pretty mysterious and wonderful, that bit right there. Not sure how it happened. Aquinas was aware that it happened and named it the act of intellect. But that's really interesting when you think about that step, where we start with just the sense datum and somehow get in contact with the universal. What exactly is this relation? It could be that it's can't be analyzed further. It's just a kind of primitive relation that we hold to these universals. Maybe it's something like that. Anyway, but I just point out that that's the view. Now, I wanted to introduce to you a distinction that Aquinas makes between two states. One is called cognitio, and that is what we've been describing so far. As some Thomists put it, it's the assimilation of a form to the intellect. It's how we understand universals, even though we're only ever in touch with particulars. We just see particular birds, but somehow we also understand birdness, understand what it is to be a bird. This is meant to be a kind of sketch of how that happens. Okay, so when we assimilate that form to our intellect, Aquinas called this cognitio. And here's something from John Jenkins. He says, there is no single English expression which will serve as a wholly satisfactory translation of cognitio. In Aquinas' writings, these words, cognitio and conoscere, seem to be generic terms for intentional mental activity. The terms refer to the apprehension, whether sensible or intellectual, of a thing or proposition. Well, what's important for my purposes is to point out that this word, this state, is used to describe what would be happening even in cases of false or illusory mental states. So cognitio can be used of false and illusory mental states. So even in a case where it's not a real bird that I'm seeing, but a stuffed bird, something like that, but it appears as a real bird, this would still be called cognitio for Aquinas. Okay, contrast that with notitia, which is a success term. In order for you to have notitia, it looks like there has to actually be a real bird. You have to have actually been in touch with an actual bird. So, yeah, this is what Jenkins says. Nocere and notitia are near synonyms of conocere and cognitio, but the former pair of terms seem to be used in a more restricted sense. They seem to signify cognitio, which successfully apprehends its object. So notitia is true belief with positive epistemic status. Nocere seems to have such a belief. So he says he'll translate those by knowledge and to know. He thinks those English words, knowledge and to know, are pretty close to what Aquinas had in mind with notitia. So it's this process that started with an actual bird. It was a successful case of perception. Ended with this belief, and then that would be, according to Jenkins, what we in English would call knowledge. Okay,
So the reason I mention this distinction is it allows us to understand a kind of case that contemporary philosophers are really familiar with, which is a case like this. Suppose I'm seeing a stuffed bird that looks even more like a real bird than that stuffed bird, and I mistake it for a real bird. So this would not be a case of notitia, because I'm not actually in touch with a real bird. And in fact, it looks like I'm going to have a false belief. I say, there's a bird before me, but it's not an actual bird. It's just a stuffed bird. But suppose we rescue the truth of the belief by adding to the case that there are real birds in the vicinity. Just like, there, I can't see them. They're behind this curtain. But there really is a real bird there. So my belief is true. There is a bird here. But it looks like it's just true by luck or by accident. In contemporary epistemology, we would say this is a Gettier case, after a philosopher named Edmund Gettier, who came up with cases like these. Well, okay, I shouldn't say he came up with cases like these, because there were cases like these well before Gettier, but he made them famous, and his name got attached to it. Okay, so I think that this distinction that Aquinas was up to can explain what's going on here, can help us account for what's going on in Gettier cases. So if the difference between notitia and cognitio is this, what makes a successful perception successful is that the real bird is explaining, ultimately, this belief that I end up with. Then we get the success term. Then we call it notitia. Whereas if there's no real bird there, it's definitely just cognitio. And if there's no real bird there, and I believe that there's a bird there, and I'm right just by chance, like in the Gettier case, that would not be notitia either. So it seems like what's missing is I can't have a true belief by chance. It's got to be that what makes my belief true is part of the explanation of how I ended up with the belief. It was actually part of this process of perception. The real bird was part of the process of perception. It's no good, again, just to go back to the previous slide, it's no good if it was a fake bird that initiated this process, but then my belief ended up true just by chance. That's no good. What we need for genuine notitia, or genuine knowledge, as we'd say in English, is it was a real bird that initiated this process of perception. And so the way I put that here is this real bird has got to figure into the explanation of how I got this belief. So I do end up with a true belief, and the fact that's making it true, that real bird, is part of what explains how I got that belief. Okay, so I am suggesting that perhaps that's what Aquinas had in mind with this distinction. It looks like the distinction helps us account for Gettier cases and can explain what goes wrong in Gettier cases. In Gettier cases, my belief is true, but what makes it true is not part of the explanation of how I ended up with that belief. Does that make sense? Do you need me to explain that again? Do you want another Gettier case?
Please.
Oh, another one? Okay, here's another one. Well, another famous one involves a shaggy dog that looks like a bird, but that, or sorry, a shaggy dog that looks like a sheep. But that's a lot like the stuffed bird case. So here's another one. This is one of Gettier's original cases. So Gettier asks you to imagine a case where somebody's applying for a job. I believe it's Smith who's applying for a job. So Smith is like on the couch waiting to go in for the interview, and he overhears the boss say, the man who has 10 coins in his pocket is going to get the job. The man who has 10 coins in his pocket is going to get the job. Don't ask me why, but that's what the boss says. I want to hire the guy with 10 coins in his pocket. Okay, and now this makes the case even weirder, but Smith pats the pocket of the person next to him and somehow realizes that that guy, Jones, has 10 coins in his pocket. Smith concludes, so Jones is going to get the job. He's got 10 coins in his pocket. I think I told that story wrong. So what the boss says is Jones is going to get the job. Sorry, not the guy who has 10 coins in his pocket. He's going to get the job. The boss says Jones is going to get the job. Smith pats the pocket of Jones, realizes he's got 10 coins in his pocket, and Smith concludes the man who has 10 coins in his pocket is going to get the job. Okay, Now here comes the twist in the story. Jones is not going to get the job. So it looks like Smith is going to end up with a false belief. Smith had believed that the guy with 10 coins in his pocket is going to get the job because he thought Jones was going to get the job, and Jones has 10 coins in his pocket. Turns out Jones is not a viable candidate at all. Jones is not going to get the job. But Smith gets the job. Unbeknownst to Smith, he has 10 coins in his pocket too. I guess this is back when people carried coins. We don't really do that anymore. So then Smith ends up with a true belief. He ends up with the belief that the guy who gets the job has 10 coins in his pocket, and that ends up as true because he gets the job and he has 10 coins in his pocket. But it was just by chance. His evidence was sort of misleading. He had relied on the boss's testimony that Jones was going to get the job. But it turned out that testimony was misleading, and his belief ended up true just by chance. Okay, in retrospect, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that one. I should have just done a stopped clock. I just realized that now. Should have just done a stopped clock. And I'll just do that real quick. Maybe the problem with Berkeley is you don't have any clocks. Is that the problem? That's why everyone's 10 minutes late all the time. So imagine there's a clock here, and it was stopped, but at exactly 7:30. Yeah, that's what it is. So it stopped at 7:30 a.m., and you don't have any markers either. Oh, there you go. All right. Okay, so it stopped at 7:30 this morning. You look at it at 7:30 p.m., not knowing that it stopped. You end up with the belief that it's 7:30 p.m. Your belief is true. It is 7:30 p.m., but most people want to say this wasn't really a case of knowledge. You were right just by chance. What do you think about that? Okay, you ended up with a true belief, but just by chance? Okay, so what we can say here is the problem was your belief was that it's 7:30 p.m., you hold that belief. This isn't a case of like ordinary visual perception where you see a bird. You hold the belief that it's 7:30 p.m. because of this experience you were having. You saw a clock that looked like this. And for all, like, you have reason to believe that the clock is reliable. So you believe it's 7:30 p.m. because the clock looked like this. But the clock looked like this not because it really is 7:30 p.m., not because it is 7:30 p.m., but because it was 7:30 a.m. when this stopped. Okay, so you hold a belief, and the explanation of why you hold it doesn't trace back to the truth. You hold it ultimately not because it is 7:30 p.m., but because it was 7:30 a.m. when this clock stopped. Okay, so I think something like that is happening here in the bird case. When it's just a fake bird, your belief definitely, I mean, it isn't even true. So it's not the case that what makes your belief true figures into the explanation. And in the Gettier case, what makes your belief true is actually over here. These guys are what make your belief true. But they don't figure into the explanation of how you ended up with this belief. It was this guy that explains why you ended up with this belief. Okay, so that's why this wouldn't really be a case of knowledge or notitia according to Aquinas. Okay, so that's the suggestion, that knowledge is believing something because it's true. And I'll give you some more reasons to think that this is what knowledge amounts to. This just is the analysis of knowledge. One line of argument is that it looks like it can handle these different kinds of cases. So here are a lot of ways that we get knowledge. We get knowledge through our senses. We've looked at visual perception already, so I'm not going to mention other cases of perception. But it looks like in the good cases of perception, where we end up with knowledge, what makes our belief true figures into the explanation of our belief. Okay, if you take an ordinary case of memory, like when you remember what you had for breakfast this morning, I had a breakfast burrito. I don't know what you had, but that's what I had. I had a breakfast burrito. And I know that because I'm having a kind of memorial experience right now. I sort of reached back into my mind, so to speak, and like consulted my mind and asked it the way our students ask ChatGPT for the answers these days. I asked my mind, what did I have for breakfast this morning? And it produced this little memorial experience. In the good case, where that's an accurate memory, if we wondered, why am I having that memory? It's because I actually did have that breakfast burrito this morning. So what makes my belief true figures in the explanation of why I'm having this memorial experience. It sort of left a trace in my mind, so to speak. And then that memorial experience is what I consulted when I was wondering what I had for breakfast this morning. And it was that memorial experience that explains why I ended up with the belief that I have. So yeah, I have the belief because of the memorial experience, and I'm having that memorial experience because it's true, it actually happened. Okay, testimony is going to work in just the same way. So let's see, what do I know by way of testimony? Okay, Francesca told me that she got a creek running through campus called Strawberry Creek. And I just believed her. That's how gullible I am. I just took her word for it. So if that's knowledge, if she wasn't messing with me, then I believe that that creek is called Strawberry Creek because she told me, so I was relying on her testimony. And in order for that to be knowledge, if we continue the explanation back to figure out where she got that belief, it better trace back to the truth. She heard it from somebody else who heard it from somebody else who was actually in a position to know, I guess. Yeah, I guess it might just trace back all the way to whoever dubbed it Strawberry Creek, I guess. Is that what happened? Yeah. All right. So that's how testimony works. Rational intuition is a little bit trickier. These are a little bit trickier. So rational intuition is a way that we know, for example, certain truths of mathematics. Got some mathematicians in the house. So when I'm wondering, like, what 2 plus 2 equals, I just close my eyes and think about it. I don't run an experiment. I don't use my visual apparatus. I guess when I was really young, I took people's word for it. And maybe when I was super young, I just relied on testimony. But now I've got the power to actually figure out whether it's true or false for myself. And it could be that's what's happening in cases of rational intuition is I'm somehow in touch with the truth of the matter, these mathematical truths. And that's what explains how I ended up with this belief. And again, it's deeply mysterious when you think about it, how we have that power. And like I guess like Aquinas, I'm just naming the power, I'm just calling it intuition. But somehow we have the power to figure out truths of mathematics, truths of logic, truths of philosophy, truths of morality. We know, for example, that nothing could be red and green all over at the same time. We know that genocide is wrong. That's something that we know. So yeah, all of morality is built on these sort of rock bottom basic intuitions. And if those are good, if those count as knowledge, it better be that we have the right kind of contact with the truths that help explain how we end up with those beliefs. Okay, let me say a little bit about deduction and induction, and then we'll move to debunking arguments. I'm going to skip what Aquinas said about intuition. Okay, I was going to say this. This is a little bit in the weeds, so to speak, for big fans of Aristotle and Aquinas. I think I'll just tell you what this view of knowledge says about cases of deduction. Because on the face of it, it looks like deduction is going to be challenging for this view, because if you run an argument and then you believe the conclusion of that argument, and I asked you what explains your belief in the conclusion, it seems really awkward to say the truth of the conclusion itself. Instead, it seems more natural to say it's the premises. That's why I believe the conclusion. And so that would be bad for this view of knowledge that I'm suggesting. Because what the view of knowledge says is, in order for you to know a proposition, it better be that the truth of that proposition figures into the explanation of why you believe it. But in cases where we're following a proof and doing some deduction, it looks like what explains my belief in the conclusion is actually my belief in the premises. It's not the truth of the conclusion itself. It's my belief in the premises. Okay, so here's a quick little argument. All vines are broad-leaved. All broad-leaved plants are sap congealers at the leaf stalk. All sap congealers at the leaf stalk are deciduous. Oh, that means all vines are deciduous. Okay, so again, the problem seems to be we want to explain how I could know this is true on the basis of an argument like this in such a way that it's consistent with that view of knowledge that I suggested a minute ago. Could it really be the case that What's happening is I believe this ultimately because it's true. Isn't it rather the case that I believe this because of these? Okay, so here's what I think is going on when we run through a deduction like this. We can represent what we come to know about the premises using little Venn diagrams. So what the first premise tells us is, okay, all the vines are broadleaved. So if I collected all the vines in the world in this circle and all the broadleaved things in that circle, the vines would be a subset of the broadleaved things. And we can do the same thing with step two. What we learned there is the broadleaved plants are a subset of plants that congeal their sap at the leaf stalk. So here are all the sap congealers, here are all the broadleaf things. We're already in a position to draw a conclusion, namely like all the vines are sap congealers at the leaf stalk. But the argument has one more step. All of these sap congealers at the leaf stalk are deciduous. Okay, so what I think is going on in cases of deduction like this, you don't have to have an image like this in your mind. This is just representing what the premises get you in a position to see. It gets you in a position to appreciate this kind of relationship between these categories. And what the conclusion says is that first category, the vines, are a subset of the deciduous category. The vines are contained within the deciduous circle. And when we do basic sort of categorical logic like this and use Venn diagrams, the way we know that an argument's valid is after I represent the premises, I don't have to do anything else to represent the conclusion. The conclusion's already there. And you can see that the conclusion's already there. I've represented the premises. Here's the conclusion. And so what might be going on, and this would be consistent with the view of knowledge that I suggested a minute ago, which, by the way, is called explanationism. So here's what might be going on in a way that's consistent with explanationism. The premises put me in a position to appreciate the truth of the conclusion, to see the truth of the conclusion. So when I represent it graphically with Venn diagrams, you can literally see the conclusion here. But even if you don't actually draw the picture, if you grasp the premises, you now see that the conclusion's true. And so it's a bit like, you know, if you start with a puzzle and all the pieces are mixed up, you can't see what the image is. But when you put the pieces together, now you can see what the image is. And in that case, like, the image explains your belief about what this puzzle is an image of. So similarly here, once we put all the pieces together, the conclusion's there. And so it could be that what happens is the premises get you in a position to see that the conclusion's true. And now the truth of the conclusion does explain why you believe that it's true. The premises, I don't really like this metaphor, but I don't know, maybe this will help you. The premises are a bit like a ladder that you use to climb up to a roof and then kick it away because you're done with it. So yeah, the premises get us in a position to appreciate the truth of the conclusion, and then it's the truth of that conclusion that explains why we believe the conclusion. Okay, so explanationism gets the right result. We do know for, on the basis of those premises, but what's happening is we believe that 4 is true because we see the conclusion, and the premises get us in a position to see that the conclusion is true. Okay, just a couple more notes about induction. So these are some other kind of problematic cases for explanationism. So I looked this up recently because I wasn't sure if this was just like a philosophical fiction or what the hell is. Urban legends, like a philosophical urban legend that all emeralds are green, but I'm pretty sure it's true. I think all emeralds are green. Okay, if it wasn't true, we would just use a different example. But the reason this is supposed to be kind of puzzling is that seems like something we can know, all emeralds are green. But it looks like that's puzzling on explanationism because in order for us to know that, the fact that all emeralds are green needs to explain why I believe that all emeralds are green, but I have not seen all the emeralds. So how could the fact that all the emeralds are green explain my belief that all the emeralds are green if I haven't seen all the emeralds, right? I have not had all the emeralds assembled in front of me, seen that they're all green. Okay, so that's why this is a little bit harder to account for in explanationism than perception and memory and testimony, etc. But here's a little move you can make if you were attracted to explanationism and you wanted to account for this. He could say, yes, I do believe that all emeralds are green. And it's true that the explanation of why I believe this is all the emeralds I've seen are green. That's the best I can say. Every single one that I've seen is green. But if I've seen enough emeralds, if it's not just like one or two, if I've seen a lot of emeralds, then it becomes the case that what explains the fact that all the emeralds I've seen are green is that all the emeralds are green. And that's why all the ones I've seen are green, because all of them are green. Okay, then we've got this little chain of explanation that terminates with the truth of my belief. And so explanationism gives the right result. I do know that all emeralds are green, and I believe it ultimately because it's true. Okay, and then a last difficult case, and then we'll get to the debunking stuff. Here's another puzzling case. It's at least on the surface a kind of puzzling case. I think I know that the sun will rise tomorrow, and maybe you do too. But how could that be on explanationism? Because doesn't explanationism require some fact in the future explaining my current belief? In order for me to know that the sun will rise tomorrow on explanationism, I would have to be believing it because it's true, but it's true in the future. The truth is that the sun will rise tomorrow. So wouldn't that require kind of a weird backwards causation in order for me to know that the sun will rise tomorrow, according to explanationism? Well, here's a story you can tell that would help you see how explanationism can account for this kind of case. So I do believe that the sun rises every day. That's something else I believe. Set this one aside for a minute. Here's something else I believe. I believe the sun rises every day. And that's going to be a little bit like all emeralds are green. I believe the sun rises every day because the sun's risen every day I've seen. And if I've seen enough days, then what makes that true is the sun rises every day. That's why the sun has risen every day I've seen. So just as in the emeralds case, it looks like I get to know that the sun rises every day. And then maybe what I'm doing is a little bit of very quick, easy deduction. From my belief that the sun rises every day, I deduce that it's going to rise tomorrow. Because tomorrow is another day. Right, so I see this little Venn diagram in my head. Like, here are all the days. Looks like the sun's rising on all the days. And guess what? Tomorrow's a day. So I can see that tomorrow is one of those things in which the sun rises. Okay, so that's how explanationism could account for knowledge about the future. Okay, I guess I wanted to at least quickly gesture at how this view of knowledge would allow us to have knowledge of God's existence. So I think the main avenues of knowledge of God's existence, I mean, if you actually saw God, that'd be great. That'd be awesome if you had like a nice visual experience. You had a little theophany, God showed up. That'd be pretty nice. So that hasn't happened to me yet, but maybe one day. So I think for most people, it's testimony and deduction. I think that's what most people are doing. Either believing what they've heard, maybe the testimony of other people, or the testimony of the Bible, or the testimony of the church, something like that. Or they're using some arguments from natural theology to come to know that God exists. And since we've already explained how those work on explanationism, you could see how, according to explanationism, these would be some viable avenues to knowing about God. And I guess I think that's kind of nice, because people are often dismissive of testimony, as though it's not really a good source of knowledge. I guess it comes to my mind that was the motto of the Enlightenment, right? No, actually, it's the motto of the Royal British Society, right? Which is the oldest scientific organization in the world, which is on the word of nobody, but in Latin, nullius in verbum, on the word of nobody. And what they meant was, don't believe anything just because someone else told you. You got to like see it for yourself. You got to do it yourself. You got to run the experiment yourself, which I think is like really ambitious to believe things about the natural world only if you've actually seen them yourself. That doesn't seem to be the way that science works. That was just an example of how some people are kind of dismissive of testimony and instead have a quite exalted view of perception. But I think if you reflect on the way that science itself works, there's a whole lot of testimony involved, if only just reading other people's papers and trusting that what they're telling you is true. And reading books about science, like in your undergraduate education or graduate education, we're taking a lot of people's word for it. We're relying a lot on testimony. And if we think that's good, as long as the original testifier was actually connected with the truth, well, the same thing could happen with the sort of testimony that is offered in the Bible or by the church. All right, let's talk about debunking arguments a little bit. Yeah, okay, so this is one more line of thought, actually, one more bit of support in favor of explanationism. So when people give you debunking arguments, they often say things like this. Well, you just believe that because, and then they fill in the blanks to try to undermine your view. Maybe they'll say, I don't know, they might try to debunk your political beliefs in this way. Well, you just believe that because you read the Daily Worker every day or something like that. Or you just believe that because, I was going to say because you go to Berkeley. You just believe that because, I don't know, what are some other examples of debunking arguments? I'm trying not to use like a really classic one about religion, which is you just believe that because of who your parents were and where you were raised, etc. I guess we could just do that with political beliefs. If you find out that somebody was raised in Sweden by atheist parents, and you find out that they're an atheist, you might say like, oh, you're just an atheist because you were raised in the most atheist country in the world by atheist parents or something like that. So that's the way debunking arguments are typically presented. They try to say, you hold a certain belief, and not because it's true, but rather for this other reason. Maybe this would have been a better example. When we try to like debunk people's beliefs by pointing out that they suffer from a kind of like racial animus or sexism or something like that, if they've got any kind of bias, we point that out. Well, you just believe that because of this racial animus you have or these sexist biases that you have. So that's how debunking arguments work. We take a belief that somebody has, like the defendant is surely guilty or something like that. And we say, well, you just believe that because he's got a face tattoo or something like that, or because of his race or his sex or whatever. And what we're trying to say is you hold a certain belief, not because it's true, but for these other reasons that aren't connected to the truth. And that suggests that we think knowledge requires connection to the truth, and in fact, an explanatory connection. We think that in order to know something, you need to believe it because it's true. If I can show that you believe it for some other reason, then I have undermined your belief, I've debunked your belief. And that's just what explanationism says. Explanationism is just the view that you know something if and only if you believe it because it's true. You better not be believing it for some other reason. You need to believe it because it's true. Okay, so that, as I said, is like an additional line of support for explanationism. I wanted to give you an example of a debunking argument. This is the best one I came up with. I don't know if it's great, but this happened to me. This is like a little bit of autobiography, real life story. In one of the first times I presented my philosophical work publicly at a grad conference, somebody asked me about this in the Q&A. Are you familiar with this? Have you seen that? Okay. I wasn't familiar with it until grad school. And somebody in the Q&A was like, well, you know how one is equivalent to 0.999 repeating forever. And I was like, let me stop you right there. It's a little bit smaller. It's a little bit smaller. Which is a very common reaction. And if it's your first time seeing that, you might have the same reaction. That was my reaction the first time I had it. I was like, no, one is not equivalent to 0.999 repeating. 0.999 repeating is a little bit smaller. Okay, and nobody corrected me in the Q&A, so I get to live with that shame for my whole life, knowing that I was totally wrong, because what I found out later is, although I had hoped that, you know, I was actually connected to the truth there. I hoped that was a genuine case of like rational intuition, where I was seeing the truth. Just like I can see that 2 + 2 = 4, and I can see that like parallel lines on a plane will never touch. And I can see that like the largest side of a triangle is going to be opposite the largest angle if there is one. These are all things that I can like see with rational intuition. I was hoping that the same thing was happening here. Oh, yeah, I can just see that one's just a little bit bigger than 0.999 repeating.
But what I found out later was I was actually confusing the infinite decimal with a finite decimal of indeterminate length. I was really failing to grasp the infinite decimal and just thinking, like, I don't care how many nines you put there, eventually you're going to stop, and it's going to be less than one. So it's the eventually you're going to stop bit. That was my mistake. And so I realized, like, well, I didn't actually hold that belief because it was true. I held it on the basis of a confusion. So debunking arguments like this can help us see that we've ignored certain evidence or we've improperly evaluated evidence, so we're not actually connected to the truth. And so that's what might happen if somebody convinces you that you actually would be, yeah, if you really just believe something because your parents told you, and somebody points that out to you, then maybe what you come to believe is, I've ignored evidence, I've improperly evaluated the evidence I've been given. I just wanted to, okay, here's a better example. So Freud suggested that religious beliefs, especially Christianity, was a product of wish fulfillment. Here we go, that's nice. So that was an attempted debunking argument. The proposal was, you think you believe in God because of, you know, testimony of the Bible and the church and natural theology and so on. You think you've got all these good bits of evidence that are connecting you to the truth, but really the reason you believe that God exists is wish fulfillment. And that's not connected to the truth. It's just because you want a benevolent father figure in the sky who loves you and wants to take care of you. That's why you really believe it. So if that convinces you, it's because what you're becoming convinced of is, I'm not actually connected to the truth. I'm improperly evaluating the evidence. I'm like deceiving myself. The evidence is really no good. It's really wish fulfillment that explains my belief. Okay, so that's how debunking arguments are supposed to work. We're given a bit of evidence that's supposed to convince us that, yeah, I think I've got, yeah, so it's supposed to convince us that that's happening. I'm not actually connected to the truth. Something else explains my belief. My belief is a result of this process that wasn't really tracking the truth. It was an off-track process. Okay, I wanted to talk about two kinds of debunking arguments in particular, and then I'll stop. I wanted to make it real personal, since this is a Thomistic Institute. What about this one? Catholicism's true. there's a little guy. Cute little doggo. Muscular doggo. Believing that Catholicism's true. Okay, what we would like as Catholics, I'm a Catholic, by the way, didn't mention that yet. I am a Catholic. What I would like, and so I believe that Catholicism's true, what I would like is for that belief to be based on the truth. I'd like to be able to cite arguments and evidence that show that I'm really connected to the truth. In just the same way that if you ask me, are all vines deciduous? I could give you that argument and show you, look, now you see that the conclusion's true. I'd like to be able to give you arguments and evidence like that, that show you that I'm really connected to the truth. That's what I would like. That's the ideal. But you've probably heard this kind of objection before. Hey, if you'd been born elsewhen, you would have had very different religious beliefs. If you'd been born in Pakistan, probably would have been a Muslim. If you'd been born in India, I don't know, certain parts of India, would have been a Hindu. If you'd been born in Sweden, probably would have been an atheist, etc. So a lot of people throughout the history of philosophy have given exactly this kind of argument, this elsewhere, elsewhen argument. And it's proposed as a kind of debunking argument. It's supposed to lower your confidence in your belief and, in fact, make you skeptical that the belief's true. What the suggestion is this. It's kind of like Freud's suggestion, except it's not wish fulfillment doing the work. The proposal is, your belief is not a result of the truth. It's not explained by the truth that Catholicism is true. Rather, it's explained by early teaching and socialization, by custom and example. You just learned from your parents and your culture. That's the proposal. You were essentially indoctrinated. That's it. You were brainwashed, is the proposal. That's why you believe that Catholicism is true. It's because of the social forces that were operating on you when you were younger. And these social forces were not connected to the truth. That's the proposal.
Okay, so does that work? And can explanationism help us figure out whether that works? So I think that what this proposal, what this attempted debunking argument shows at most is that I might have had different evidence. If I had been born elsewhere and elsewhen, and my parents had told me different things, if they had told me that Hinduism's true or that atheism's true, if they had told me one of those things, then I would have had different evidence. Maybe I would have read different books, would have gone to a different kind of worship service, not a Christian worship service, some other kind of worship service. I would have had very different evidence. But does that show that my current evidence is no good or that I'm not connected to the truth? And then I put the answer in parentheses in case you're wondering. I think the answer is no. And a way you can see that is you can realize that this sort of consideration, if it was successful in this case, it kind of looks like it would be successful in every case. Right? Like just pick any belief you have. What's another belief I have? I don't know, just pick any sort of philosophical, moral, mathematical belief, scientific. Oh, we should just do a scientific belief. So imagine that you were a friend of Copernicus back in the day before he published his work. He showed you, though. He wanted your comments on an early draft of his work. So you read it and you're convinced and you believe, oh, yes, the sun is the center of the solar system. The earth moves around the sun. And you believe that. And if I asked you, why do you believe that? You would point to the arguments and evidence that you've just gotten from your friend Copernicus. But surely it's true that if you had been born elsewhere and elsewhen, you wouldn't have believed that. Right? Or at least you easily might not have. Maybe you would have gotten lucky. But you easily might not have been a heliocentrist had you been born elsewhere and elsewhen. Should that worry you? Or I guess, let's just do any sort of scientific, let's just do this one. So do we believe that diseases are caused by germs, right? Yes. But now think about like how long humans have existed and all the different places and times you could have been born in. What are the odds you would have believed in germs if you had been born in one of those other times and one of those other places? I guess in the last, when did we get germ theory? Like late mid-1800s or something? Late 1800s? If you were born at certain times in certain places after then, there's a good chance you would have believed in germ theory. By any time before then, you would not have believed in germs. So does that undermine your current belief that diseases are caused by germs? I don't think so. I think you should go ahead and keep believing that diseases are caused by germs. Because at most what we've been shown is I might have had different evidence. Yeah, I easily might have been born in a time and place where I would have had different evidence. In fact, inferior evidence, bad evidence. That doesn't show that my current evidence is no good or that I'm not connected to the truth. I might have been less well off. Or just think about how this argument would also apply to the atheist, right? So the religious skeptic. Imagine somebody who's quite confident that atheism's true. We could easily point out to such a person that had they been born at a different time in a different place, they wouldn't have been atheists. Atheism is just as historically contingent as Catholicism. So I think we should all agree that just pointing out that I might have had different evidence, I might have had what would be by my lights inferior evidence, isn't enough to show that I'm not connected to the truth. I would need something extra. Okay, so there's a brief response to this attempted debunking argument. I don't think that this attempted debunking argument works. It doesn't show that my belief is not ultimately connected to the truth. It just proposes that there's like this other bad influence that might have been acting on me. But just showing that like there's a possible bad influence that might have been affected, that might have been affecting me, is not enough to undermine my belief. Okay, last one. There's our old friend Sam Harris. I assume he believes that incest is wrong, but to be honest, I don't totally know. But I bet he believes that incest is wrong. This is just supposed to be a kind of enlightened, secular sort of thinker, not a religious person, who believes that incest is wrong. So what you would like, I believe that incest is wrong too, for the record, and maybe you do too. Do you guys think incest is wrong? Quick poll. Okay, great. Are you thinking about it?
No.
Yeah, you are now. Now it seems really wrong, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. That's good. That's a sign that your mind is functioning properly. Okay. So here we all are believing that incest is wrong. What we would like is for that belief to be explained by the truth. We would like it to be the case that I'm believing that incest is wrong because I've actually got this connection to the truth. Maybe it's arguments. Maybe it's evidence. Maybe it's the kind of evidence that's supplied by rational intuition. Maybe it's something I can just see. But we would like our belief that incest is wrong to be explained by the fact that incest is wrong, a fact that we are appreciating. That's what we would like to be the case. But here's another kind of debunking argument that philosophers like to talk a lot about. It's an evolutionary debunking argument. So isn't it the case that we have evolutionary explanations of our hardwired moral sentiments and of our social taboos? So when you thought about incest and you got that feeling of disgust, do you know that there's an evolutionary explanation of why you have that feeling of disgust? The evolutionary explanation is incest is really maladaptive. Did you know that? Inbreeding is not a good strategy. It's not a good reproductive strategy. It it tends to produce fewer children and less healthy children. Inbreeding is not a good reproductive strategy. And so there was a selective pressure on organisms to develop a kind of hardwired incest avoidance mechanism. And it looks like we humans do have one. And the hardwired mechanism is turn off sexual attraction to anyone who was around when you were a child. That's how it works. We've got a little bit of our brain that makes you afraid of this shape. We don't have to teach kids to be afraid of this shape. This is not related to incest. This is something else. This shape, there's a little bit of our brain that produces fear just in response to that shape. You don't have to teach kids. It's because snakes were a real problem for our ancestors, and there was serious evolutionary pressure on organisms to avoid shapes like this when they see them. Okay, similarly, there was serious evolutionary pressure for organisms to avoid incest, and since we can't peer into each other's cells and see if we're related, the best we can do is just not reproduce with people who were around when we were young, because there's a high chance that they're related to us if they were around when we were young. Okay. So we've got this evolutionary explanation of our moral sentiments, and of course we've got evolutionary explanations of social taboos. So that's the way that populations enforce certain kinds of behaviors. And you can see that societies that have incest taboos tend to do better than societies that don't, right? Because if a society didn't have incest taboos, you'd have a whole lot of inbreeding going on, or at least more inbreeding. Okay, so if you think evolution operating at the population level, there's pressure for populations to develop and codify incest taboos. Okay, just like, I guess here's an example I often use of this kind of like selection pressure at the population level. Have you heard of the Quakers? Pacifists. They're still around. There's still some Quakers around. Have you heard of the Shakers? Have you? I hadn't really heard of the Shakers. Some of you have not heard of the Shakers. And here's why. It's because one of their religious, it was a religious group, and one of their doctrines was you couldn't marry. You had to be celibate. So yeah, that's why there's no more Shakers. They did not reproduce. So that was a kind of belief, and it was a taboo that a population took on board and enforced, and it was not a very adaptive taboo for that population. A more adaptive taboo is against like contraception, just FYI. Speaking of Catholicism, that'll make a population grow. Okay, so we've got these evolutionary explanations of our belief that incest is wrong. And so the worry is, look, I've got this competing explanation of why I believe that incest is wrong. I've got this evolutionary explanation. And I think that this kind of debunking argument actually works if you think that whatever capacities you're using, whatever cognitive capacities you're using to form beliefs about what's right and wrong, if you think that all of those are the product of natural selection, and they were all given to us only with an eye towards what's adaptive, given to us by evolution, only with an eye towards what's adaptive, then I think you do have here a debunking argument. That's why I'm using Sam Harris. Do you think somebody like Sam Harris, who is non-religious, to say the least, will admit that the faculties that he's using to form judgments about what's good and bad, right and wrong, are the product of natural selection. And so if you think that all that natural selection was interested in is adaptiveness and not truth, then you got to think, like, I don't really have the right kind of connection to truth in order for this to count as knowledge. What about our friend, the Catholic doggo, again? Do they have a debunking argument here as well? Well, I think not, because if you think you have other ways of knowing about morality in addition to things that were shaped by natural selection, then you could admit that, yeah, some of the influences on my moral beliefs were the product of natural selection, but I've got other ways of knowing about what's good and bad, right and wrong. Maybe divine revelation, or maybe a sort of supernaturally endowed conscience, rational intuition, something like that. In which case, although natural selection might partly explain my moral beliefs, it's not going to be the whole explanation. And so long as these beliefs are based on the good kind of foundation, the good explanation, rather than the bad one, they will count as knowledge. These moral beliefs will count as knowledge. All right, so just quick summary. What I suggested to you was that knowledge is believing something because it's true. And if that's the case, it looks like there's a few ways we can know that God exists. I tried to convince you that evolutionary debunking arguments are a problem for atheists, and that elsewhere debunking argument doesn't look so very bad for Christians. All right, thanks for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.